This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. America has had a long romance with the West. Jonathan Rabin's new book, Badland, is about the homesteaders at the turn of the century who were lured from other countries to eastern Montana and the Dakotas by brochures that promised fertile farmland. What the homesteaders found instead was dry land and inhospitable winters. Some of their abandoned, ruined houses still dot the prairie. In fact, that's one of the things that drew Rabin to the homesteader's story. The New York Times called Badland one of the most illuminating books written about rural America in many years. Rabin is himself newly arrived in America. A few years ago, he moved to Seattle from England. I asked him why he's so interested in these wrecks of houses and in the homesteaders of the early 1900s.
I came out west and felt myself to be short of roots and reasons to be here, and started exploring how other Europeans had landed up seeking a home in the United States, and these just seemed a paradigmatic example, really, of Europeans coming out their heads full of American dreams, trying to make a home for themselves in a strange land. And gosh, that land itself is about as strange as you can get.
What is strange about the land that you're writing about?
It's treeless, it's bare. It's a land of shale and sagebrush and dry coulees and low buttes. It's a land that doesn't resemble anything that you could find in Europe. I mean, this is the northern plains, more or less on the state line between North Dakota and Montana, eastern Montana, western North Dakota. And it was advertised to the people who came there as a new Arcadia. It was presented in pamphlets issued by the railroads as this green and fertile land where anyone, you didn't even need to be a farmer to do it, could realize an American dream of prosperity as an independent farmer.
When you were driving around eastern Montana, did you find a lot of abandoned homes and abandoned little towns?
Oh, it's a landscape of ruins. The dead vastly outnumber the living there. And you look across this great oceanic sweep of empty prairie, and most of the signs of human habitation are of houses long, long abandoned, some of them sinking straight back into the soil, some of them still standing, I mean, to the point where you can walk in through their front doors and find clothes in the closet and almost the remains of the last meal on the kitchen table.
Tell us a little bit more about what you found inside some of these abandoned homes.
Well, it really started with my friend and I searching for the remains of the homestead that his grandfather had set up in 1910, and he'd never been back to it. And we mounted a little expedition from Seattle and went out to find the site of the homestead. There was practically nothing left. Things scattered in the grass. The house and outbuildings had gone. We found a few objects, like his father's sled, or the remains of what had once been his father's sled, bits out of a Model T Ford, a milking bucket, that kind of thing. And then we found the remains of the bonfire left by the family when they finally quit in 1926. And I pulled out from this blackened earth a little silver medallion. I didn't know what it was. It was the head of what looked like a Greek goddess. I think now probably Mnemosyne, the goddess of memory. And I handed it to Mike and asked him to figure out what it was. He turned it over in his fingers and he said, "I know what this is. It's the clasp to an old-timey photograph album. They must have burned the family photos when they left." And I found that extraordinarily poignant as a thought, that these people simply could not bear to take away from the prairie the memory of the hope, the optimism, the smiling photographs that they brought to it.
The homesteading boom started in 1909 after Congress passed the Homesteading Act. Tell us what the Act had to say.
Well, the Act basically enlarged the size of the basic homestead in semi-arid lands, which is a kind of euphemism, from 160 acres to 320 acres. 320 acres is half a square mile of land, and it looked at the time munificent.
And the railroad companies really wanted settlers to come and become homesteaders. The railroad companies needed people living along the railroad lines if the railroad lines were going to succeed, so they really had a vested interest in homesteading. And you write about some of the advertising literature, the brochures that the railroad companies published to entice people from America and from abroad to come settle places like eastern Montana. Would you describe some of these ads and brochures?
Well, they were works of grand romantic fiction. They were written by copywriters, I imagine, who worked in offices in New York and Chicago, who themselves had never set eyes on the prairie of eastern Montana. They were illustrated partly by line drawings, in which the artists were wonderfully fanciful about what the landscape might contain. They drew in trees when there were no trees. They drew in fields and hedges and all sorts of things. Also by photographs, which were taken not very far away from the free land that was on offer, but they weren't actually photographs of free land. And they painted this Arcadian picture of the riches of the land, its fertile soil, its beneficent climate. And people fell basically for a landscape in a book. When they finally arrived in eastern Montana, very often after a transatlantic voyage and a long and exhausting railway trip from New York out to the west, they found themselves the proud proprietors of 320 acres of treeless dust.
Why don't you describe how, for instance, the climate was described in some of the railroad advertising brochures and what the climate really turned out to be like?
Oh, the railroad brochures minimized the cold, and the cold there was and is intense, often sinking to minus 40 Fahrenheit, which people suffered in tar paper shacks, you know, these makeshift little houses that they built for themselves for their first winter on the prairie. And the brochures maximized the amount of rainfall. In fact, you know, 15 inches, I think, is taken as the sort of real measure of where arable land really becomes arable. And they played up the amount of rainfall that was falling on the prairie. In actual fact, what was coming down was probably 11, 12, 13 inches on average. But the brochures made much of the fact not only that there was sufficient rain to make this soil yield wheat and barley and those other things, but also they had this wonderful sort of pseudoscience that they were promoting. Rain follows the plow. Rain follows settlement. And rain especially follows the railroad. They dug up Louis Agassiz's son, another Professor Agassiz, who came up with this splendid theory, which is that if you drive a locomotive fast enough through the landscape, some kind of electromagnetic something or other takes place in the atmosphere, and rain clouds miraculously form over the passing train in the landscape, so that the railroads themselves were bringing rain to the dry prairie. And all this, of course, was poppycock. But the settlers didn't know that as they read the brochures.
Wow, I think the guy who wrote that tried to sell me a car once.
I think he sold me one, actually.
Well, you found something called Campbell's Soil Culture Manual. Why don't you describe that?
Oh, that was the Bible of the dry farming movement. And every settler, you know, there were probably three books in these people's claim shacks when they started out. One would be the Bible, one would be Pilgrim's Progress, and one would be Campbell's Soil Culture Manual of 1907. Campbell was this Scottish Presbyterian who had an experimental farm in Nebraska, from where he promulgated his wonderful theories about, and they were a mixture of science and Calvinism, really, how you could turn the driest land into a reservoir of water, which would see you through the dry years. If you managed to Calvinistically hoard and save every single drop of rain that fell whenever rain did fall. And he had his patent subsurface packer, his patent ploughs and harrows and discs, and he believed in capillary attraction as being the great force that could be harnessed by the homesteader to make his dry land moist. And that, too, didn't really amount to much as science, but it was science's miracle, which so much of the settler's science was. Science believed in as a kind of religion that if you could understand the scientific principles of something like capillary attraction, you'd be saved, and the desert could be made to bloom and turn into a garden.
So, great, we have a combination of advertising hype and pseudoscience.
We do. And, of course, pseudoscience was believed in. Almost as a kind of a religion, you know, the miracles of science, and the miracles of science, one of which was the turning of dry land into the garden, were very much like, you know, biblical miracles. It was like the feeding of the 5,000. And people looked at now, when you go to the prairie now, you look at the way in which that landscape is dominated by ruined schoolhouses. You don't see church spires or church towers as you might see back east or in Europe. You see these gaunt, windowless schoolhouses, one to every hill. And they remind you that this was a secular society, a utopian society, a society that believed that education and science would be the making of it. And I think they are a reminder of how much people believe, very often credulously and innocently, in the claims of science and the claims of man's knowledge and man's capacity to dominate nature. Because, of course, for the homesteading experiment to work at all, man had to have conquered nature. And in 1910, people really believed that that had happened, I think.
My guest is Jonathan Rabin, author of the new book, Bad Land. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Jonathan Rabin, author of the new book, Bad Land, about the homesteaders who were lured to eastern Montana in the early 1900s. A lot of homesteaders eventually gave up. They couldn't make a go of it. It was too cold in winter. It was too dry in summer. The life was just too hard, too much isolation. What do you know of some of the turning points for settlers who gave up?
Oh, it was a combination of weather and credit, I think, that did for most people, because they happened to arrive in a rare run of relatively moist years, and it looked for an instant as if the great experiment was going to pay off, that they were going to build this utopian society on the prairie. Their crops sprouted, the wheat came up, their cattle fattened. And between about 1910 and 1915, there was a sort of giddy sense that everything was working. The science was proving its magic. And they built their schools, they formed themselves into communities. Those who couldn't speak English learned their English. They knitted themselves into a kind of rural society, very, very much like a European farm community, really. And then two things got them. One was the change in the weather, in which Montana reverted to its usual character, which was distressingly cold winters and very, very dry springs and summers. And the other was actually caused by their success, because as they seemed to be succeeding, so it became the season of the smiling bank manager. And bank managers roamed the prairie in Model T Fords, offering cheap loans to buy farm machinery to the homesteaders. 5.5% go off, buy a tractor, buy a baler, buy a combined harvester, and triple, quadruple your output. This thing will pay for itself within a couple of seasons. And the homesteaders then got themselves into monthly payments, and monthly payments that as soon as the weather changed, they were unable to meet. So it was this combination of terrible weather and those brown envelopes with windows in them that are the nightmares of everybody.
Did you come from the kind of family that ever picked up and moved when you were young? Is that kind of movement a part of your formative experience?
Yes, it was, and it was a very un-English thing, I think. My family was almost totally peripatetic. Every couple of years, we seemed to be picking up sticks and trying to set down roots in a new place. My father was, first of all, when I was born in 1942, he was an army officer, and then he worked for a voluntary organization for a couple of years after the war, and then he became a theological student, and then he became a curate and a priest, moving from parish to parish. And I found myself, you know, no sooner had I put down roots in a place, started getting to know people at a school, I was moving on, and very often from the remote countryside to a quite big city to a suburb to a small town and so on. So I was getting to see a lot of different societies, but always really as an outsider, as a stranger looking in. And just about at the time in which I began to feel that we were at home there, suddenly we weren't. And I think that's a terribly good training, really, for a writer.
Your father was an Anglican clergyman. And I'm wondering if you were interested in the different forms of religion you found in your research on the prairie.
Oh, yes, very much so. I grew up listening to my father arguing over the dinner table about theology. And I think it sharpened, which he always called the Queen of the Sciences. And I found myself in later life, though I am not a believer, fascinated by the kinds of theological ideas that people dream up for themselves in order to make sense of their lives, in particular landscapes. Mm-hmm. And on the prairie, I was fascinated by the way in which that early belief in science, in man, in secular society, seemed to give way at some point under the impact of the weather, of poverty, of failure, to a moving from one Bible of dry farming, which was Campbell's Soil Culture Manual, to another book, the Book of Revelation, where in some ways the hideous climate of eastern Montana was far more accurately described than ever it was in the railroad pamphlets or in Campbell's manual. And watching the growth on the prairie of fundamentalist Christianity, one could see that those beliefs have a sort of natural geographic location in somewhere like eastern Montana, where the extremities of the weather find, you know, perfect correlatives in the descriptions of the weather in the Book of Revelation. You know, the giant hailstones, the plagues of locusts, which of course on the prairie were plagues, hideous plagues of grasshoppers, which ate the homesteaders' crops, the lightning storms, the sense of being alone under the sky with, you know, exposed to the vengeful gaze of God above, I think is a very powerful idea in that landscape. And you can see, I think, exactly how these people who in 1910 had been burbling about the efficacy of science came by the 1920s and 30s, many of them, to believe not in science at all, but in fundamentalist Christianity.
Jonathan Raven is the author of Badland.